What agreement?
It is 1 o'clock, and we're ready to get going. Gary, what's up, Doc?
Yes. Before we begin, Commissioners, in front of you, you have a laminated copy of the board agreements that you agreed to last month that we'll just have in front of your table, in front of all your meetings for the next few months, just to remind you and me of the agreements we've set as we work together. So that's what that is in front of you today. We'll start with our first policy session, Juvenile Justice System Improvement, Evidence-Based and Multi-System Approaches. Christina McMahon from the Juvenile Department will present, and she has guests. If you'd like to introduce your guests, please go forward.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. It's great to be here today. As Gary said, I'm Christina McMahon. I'm the Juvenile Department Director for Clackamas County. And with me today, I'm going to start with our invited guests who might join in when we get to the discussion part. At the end of this first row, we have Judge Colleen Gilmartin, who is our juvenile court judge here in Clackamas County. She's representing the Clackamas County Circuit Court. We have Mark McDonald, who is our assistant director at the Juvenile Department, and Kevin Long. Hi, Kevin. Kevin is the Child Welfare Program Manager for Department of Human Services here in Clackamas County. So we also expect Mary Rumba was going to try to join us from Behavioral Health, so Mary might be scooting in here momentarily. So those are the folks we asked to be present today as we kind of get into the discussion portion.
You mind writing your names? I'm sorry, writing your names on the placards in front of you.
Please. Yes, we can do that. So to my left here is Shay Bilcheck. Shay is the executive director of the Center for Juvenile Justice Reform at Georgetown University. And to his right is Alex Miller, who is one of his senior program folks from the Center of Juvenile Justice Reform as well. So they have traveled here from Washington, D.C., and will be helping us tomorrow with a site visit that we're doing with a bunch of our community partners related to our crossover youth practice model initiative that we have going that you're about to hear a little bit more about. I just wanted to give you a little bit of an introduction because we did include in the packet Shay's biography, but I wanted to let you know that Shay's background is he started out as a prosecutor in Florida, which he held different positions, including being in charge of the Juvenile Justice Bureau of his agency. He did that for 16 years and then was appointed to be the Federal Office of Juvenile Justice Delinquency Prevention Administrator and held that position during the Clinton administration, and then left there and was the executive director of the Child Welfare League of America before starting the Center for Juvenile Justice Reform about 11 or 12 years ago now at Georgetown University. So, yes, and
did you say I was old?
Tired. I'm tired.
I feel old.
So we've worked with Georgetown, the Center for Juvenile Justice Reform here in Clackamas County, for approximately the last 3 years on several very important juvenile justice system improvement initiatives that you've heard me mention in passing during my budget presentations. Those have included our multi-system collaboration. That was the first one that we did, which continues to this day. Then we have just recently finished up our evidence-based decision-making initiative, which all of these initiatives involve many different partners. And for the last, since the beginning of the year, we've been working on the crossover youth practice model. So Shay offered to come here and share the information about why this system improvement work is so important and tie it into what we're doing here in Clackamas County so that you are aware of it. We're very excited with the level of participation and commitment we've gotten from many different stakeholders throughout the county. So with that, I will turn it over to Shay. Thank you
for the opportunity to be here. I want to also introduce my colleague, Dr. Alex Miller, who is on our staff at Georgetown, the Plymouth Court School of Public Policy. Alex just recently graduated with her PhD at the University of Virginia, and we're delighted to have her join our team, focusing on a lot of the multi-systems work in our crossover youth practice model work that I'll talk about today. So again, I'm delighted to be here. I'll be honest with you, anytime I can get an invitation to come out to Oregon, I will. This is one of my favorite states in the country, so I cheated on the margins and spent 6 days, 3 days on the coast and 3 days down in Willamette. My wife just got on a plane this morning to fly home. So I am just well relaxed and ready to go and have a good discussion today about the good work that you all are involved in. I prepared a PowerPoint presentation to use as a guide. I think you may have a copy of it, hard copy, maybe not, but it's up on the screen as well to guide some of our discussion. I think when I have become familiar with the work in Clackamas, I'm drawn to the leadership, obviously, all of you have provided, but your directors of various departments have provided around bringing to life your goals that you've set, including the goal around ensuring safe, healthy, and secure communities. So I've taken the privilege of framing some of what I'm presenting around those goals so you can see exactly how some of this work is feeding into that. I think you'll also see, as we weave together in the presentation today, how where the nation has moved and where evidence has been developed about effective policy and practice around juvenile justice issues is where Clackamas has been moving as well. So you're going to see a symmetry there in terms of where the county has developed its work and its policies. In my presentation, what I'll talk about is our center a little bit, just a little bit, and what we do. Some of the advances, those national advances that I talked about, the crossover youth population that Christina just mentioned, as well as what anchors my work and what anchors the work of our center and I think effective policy and practice, which is using multi-systems approaches and how we work with children and families. The center was formed really as a byproduct of my professional experience, which was in the juvenile justice and child welfare worlds as a lawyer and as a policymaker. And the realization that we can't operate those agencies, those systems in a silo, that too often the populations we're talking about are one and the same, just at a different moment in time. So a child who may end up in the child welfare system at age 4 or 6 or 8 or 10 or 12 could easily end up in the delinquency system at age 12, 14, 16, 18, and then often in the adult system. And I'll show you some data that surrounds that. So when I moved from the Child Welfare League to Georgetown, it was to develop a center that would use a model that would encourage leadership in this area in taking that kind of multi-systems approach in creating safer communities and healthier young people and families. I'll just leave this behind. It's some of the work that we do in different domains, and some of those domains are the areas that Christina had described to you. So what is it that were the advances we've seen? I guess I want to start this with a question for you all. Question for you all.
Fear. The Marine Corps father.
But where did the fear come from? Father?
The Marine Corps father.
Okay. So I'll put that in the bucket of family.
Yes.
Okay. Fair enough. But if you think about what were the factors that steered you away from systems involvement, whether it be the delinquency system, the child welfare system?
Church.
So faith.
Yeah.
Faith? Yeah. What other ones?
My dad worked me to death.
He worked you to death. You were too tired to do anything, right?
That sounds familiar, too.
Yeah. What else? Martha?
Well, I would say strong family infrastructure. Yeah. I had a large Italian family, so mm-hmm. that takes a village kind of approach. Right. Was
about a lot of values
important.
And family connections.
Yeah.
I think parents that understand that their role is to team together in raising the kids and not go off in separate directions, if you will, mm-hmm. Which a kid will always then try to exploit, and that tends to exacerbate problems within the family and make it even worse.
Yeah. So, Jim, you mentioned faith. As part of that faith, were you involved in a lot of church-related activities?
No, not really.
So mostly just the faith and belief in what values you should live your life by.
I'd say it's my parents forcing us to follow the rules.
Okay. Yeah.
The other thing is childhood trauma mm-hmm. is another thing that has a big impact on.
Yeah.
I think there's a test to take.
ACE test.
Yeah. Adverse childhood experiences.
Yeah. Our former chair was, he always said he was way up there, 4 or 5 on that scale, and he managed to work through that most of the time.
Sonia?
Asking a really good question. So I honestly don't know.
Yeah.
I should have been probably in the system. So they say, and I've struggled with this through lots of years of therapy because I have a very challenged childhood.
Yeah.
It's you need that one caring adult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I didn't even have a caring adult. I had a pieces of paper and writing and lots of teachers, but nobody, no one caring adult. So I should have been a systems kid.
Yeah.
I had one brother who struggled with drug addiction, another brother who committed suicide after a mental health crisis after being involved in the juvenile justice system. I mean, I should not be sitting here.
Yeah. But so to some degree, that you think the teachers were there for you?
No, I don't know. Yeah. I mean, they were there, but that's a good question. I don't know the answer to it.
Yeah.
Do you mind if I ask a question?
Sure.
Because isn't there data to show that there are some people that have a natural resilience, or resiliency, am I correct?
Yeah.
Work that, while it may impact some folks, but there's, for whatever reason, there's an internal resiliency that people seem to be able to move past.
As I mentioned, I did a lot of work in the child welfare field as well as the delinquency field. You see some stories and you see kids coming out of it successfully, and you think about the resilience that they show. It's just really incredible. And then other kids may not have it.
Okay.
They have been so beaten down that they don't have it, that they need someone else or something else to kind of lift them up and support them. So, you know, you think about your goal about having safe, secure, and healthy communities. There's a segment of the population that probably needs some of those supports, needs that meaningful relationship with an adult. I mean, I think back to some of the most significant people in my life, Sonia, and they were teachers. Yeah. My third grade teacher, my sixth grade teacher, and then a college professor that helped shape my thinking and my self-concept about who I was. Now, I'm not going to diminish who my family was. That was the core shaping. But those other meaningful interruptions in my life that those people formed were also a key part of who I became later on. So when I ask the question, because when we talk about the developments we've had in the science, it frames around this developmental model, this ecological model, which is that you have this individual at the center, but the things that help shape them, where they nest in their lives, are their families. So you each have talked about that, their peer groups, their schools, and their communities, which includes their faith community. So Yuri Bronfenbrenner, who came up with this model around social ecology, really was hitting on something that today in juvenile justice we describe as our risk and needs assessments. So if you look at a tool like the JCP you use here in Oregon, it will have as dimensions the dynamics it measures, the relative strengths or weaknesses in these domains for a child, as well as their individual characteristics that help to shape whether they are at higher risk or lower risk to end up becoming involved in the juvenile justice system. And that's a lot of what we've done in our work, is to frame it around that particular model. I don't know if you have any questions about this, but I think many of your answers, I don't think we hit on peer group.
That was a big deal.
Yeah. Who you ended up hanging out with.
Yep.
And a lot of instances now if a school system is doing high levels of suspension, out-of-school suspension, we're kind of driving kids out into the community, hanging out with other kids who are being suspended rather than keeping them closer, maybe in school suspension, in order to keep them under our control a little bit more. So these are the domains, the nesting environments that we see with a lot of kids. So we have this advance in juvenile justice over the last, I would say, 10 to 15 years. One is simply, I think, due in large part to the late 1980s, early 1990s, concern about what you may remember in the news as the generation of super predators. There was a significant amount of investment by the federal government and by foundations in research around juvenile justice, as well as programming around juvenile justice. I think a lot of the programming was designed to create more alternatives to incarcerate kids, more formal justice system involvement, which I think was a perception based upon the data we were looking at back then was needed. But through the investment in research at that time, we also learned a lot of other things that are being used today, 20 years later, 15 years later, that are helping us be more effective around addressing juvenile delinquency. So one is, as you have here in Oregon, the JCP, is the use of a risk and needs assessment tool. A tool, when administered, that can give you a sense of what is the risk level that this child may offend in the future. So what is that probability? And then secondly, what are the factors that are driving that risk? So going back to the last slide, many of the domains in the risk and needs tools are these domains. So individual characteristics, are we dealing with a child who's aggressive, who's dealing with behavior that's just out of control? Are there negative family influences, child abuse and neglect? Is it a negative peer group? Are they getting gang involved? Well, all those different factors come into play. Second is the understanding that if we are using a risk and needs tool well, that we are able to then assess what's the level of intervention that's appropriate for a particular youth. So more isn't always better. Sometimes less is more. So the need for strong diversion programs for low-risk, low-level offenders, rather than bringing them more fully into the system. And this is a correlation to something you've been developing in Clackamas. Yes.
Does it recognize that, with looking at your, going back to your color slide there,
yeah,
the individual's actions and behaviors, yeah, are as much of a reactive and coping behavior, as inappropriate as they may be, to the lack of family, peer, school, or community connection, if you will, yeah, for lack of a better term. So it's an adaptive strategy. It's a poor one. It's, yeah, it's a failing one.
Yeah.
But, you know, I tend to subscribe to the idea that the kid's a blank slate, yeah, that, you know, we write on as we raise them. And if we do a poor job, it's an adaptive strategy on their part trying to figure out how to get along, basically.
Right. And I think what comes into play then is some of that resiliency. So are they able to adapt in a way that they survive,
positive,
stay positive,
like some,
or,
yeah,
or do they go a negative route? So, mm-hmm, I'll give you an example. If I'm hearing
and
you right.
And if you're in the wrong neighborhood, you're more likely to go,
yeah,
the negative route.
Right,
on top
you're drawn into an alternative, yep, lifestyle. But I think I see this a lot with kids in foster care, where if we don't do the work well, and we aren't paying attention to the child well-being factor, dimension of being in foster care. So you're in a group placement, you're moved around a lot, you're changing schools. That adaptive behavior may be, I have no chance to succeed in school at all anymore. It's almost impossible for me. I'm being moved from school to school, I'm getting different books, I'm getting different teachers, I can't even keep up, let alone think about doing homework and studying for an exam. When I'm also preoccupied, am I ever going to go home again? Or where am I going to be living 2 weeks from now? So a lot of those kids begin to act out. And their behavior is one that can lead them, perhaps somewhat intentionally, to get suspended from school. Because being suspended from school is a safer option for them than being in school and not being able to perform. That, in some ways, is that negative adaptive strategy to survive.
Yep.
I'm not going to survive here, so I'll create another environment to survive in. So I think your point's really well taken. What do you think, Martin?
I was just thinking of my uncle, who was the truant officer,
yeah,
and how he changed kids' lives. Yeah, that's what I was thinking about.
By staying connected to them, right?
He got more kids into college, more kids on the straight path than,
yeah,
anybody else.
Yeah.
Truly.
I am curious on the, we talk about individual characteristics,
yeah,
that were, and to Ken's point a little bit, there are people, parents that have done a stellar job of raising their kids,
yeah,
but they didn't have a good outcome. Both, they were in the same family, most of the kids did very well, right? And whether it's a resiliency or whatnot, it's sometimes, I think, puzzling, baffling to some parents. I was fortunate my kids did really well, but I think they're doing right, and yet something, you know,
yeah,
even though they have the right environment, I don't know. I'm kind of curious more about what those individual characteristics align with resiliencies that we're talking about.
Yeah. I'm not a psychologist by training. My wife is. So at this point, I wish she had not flown home this morning and she could be sitting on me. But I think it's that blend of nature-nurture, that there is a nature to a child when they're born and certain mechanisms, coping mechanisms, how they deal with stress that I think are part of nature, and then how you nurture in tandem with that nature can end up going really well or not so well. I often tease my wife by saying that she's the much better parent of the two of us, and that with the nature of my two kids, they did so well because of the way she was able to nurture in her parenting skills and to teach me how to be a good parent as well. So I'm not blaming the parents, but I think it's a combination of nature and nurture. Nurture happens to parents in the school environment, on the street, happens in a variety of different ways. We've also understood that keeping youth in the community or close to home, if they are going to be put out of home into a residential placement, is important. The notion of sending kids 200 miles away from the community is one that we've seen a shift away from, and seen good evidence that when we keep kids closer to the community, and I'm trying to be very clear here, closer to the community may mean in a residential program closer to the community, or may mean on probation in the community. So based upon that risk and needs assessment, we end up doing better work in terms of reducing recidivism. So we have very sophisticated research showing that when we match a youth based upon risk and need and offense type to the right level of supervision and type of service, we maximize recidivism reduction. And part of that picture is knowing this child, this youth is coming home. So the best reentry planning we can do is when the youth, if they're being placed out of home, is close to that community, and they can kind of be ready for them to be back in the community, back in school, back with a strong community support team around them, family ready to receive them back home. Those things are all done with strong reentry planning that happens better if they're closer to the community, even in out-of-home placement. And then I think we've seen continuing evidence of disproportionality in both the child welfare and juvenile justice system, and as I'll talk about in a little bit, in our crossover population of kids who are concurrently known to both child welfare and juvenile justice, that kids of color, predominantly African-American children, are disproportionately represented in that population. And then also Native American children, American Indian children, are also disproportionately represented. And in our work in Clackamas thus far, that's shown up in the data in both the child welfare population and in the juvenile justice population, that disproportionality. I know you do not have a large African-American population here, but for that size population, it is disproportionately represented in those two systems.
Okay. Question on that. Is that because there is a disconnect between how an African-American child is treated by law enforcement and the criminal justice system versus a white child who has done exactly the same offense? So do we have data that suggests that's either true or not?
Right. So I wouldn't want to paint with that broader brush, but you've identified one decision point where that might be happening. So it could be that there's a difference in treatment by law enforcement. It could be that law enforcement actually is doing its job in a fair, equitable way, but when kids are presented into the system, that there's less likelihood they'll be diverted, and more likelihood that if they're a child and family of color, they'll be brought into the formal system. That's another decision point that can happen. It might happen in disposition, that the prosecutor and judge are making determinations that when you look at the data is driving more kids of color into placement versus probation. I'm not saying that's happening in Clackamas, but I would look at six or seven different decision points, and then we would analyze every decision point to see what's happening in a particular county to learn more about what some of the root causes might be.
I think that is a point that needs to be looked at in my experience.
Right.
It tended to be a major issue.
Yeah. Well, as part of the work I hope we can do with you all is to look at some of that, particularly for the crossover population. And we work our way back from that to study the underlying populations as well. So this is the grand design. It's one of my favorite slides, because I think it captures a lot of the research that we've done in the past 15, 20 years and lays it out in one picture about how the system should operate. So first of all, there should always be a strong prevention effort in every county. Every local community should be looking at how do we prevent kids at the first sign of trouble from coming more deeply into our systems. But if there is juvenile justice entry, we want to do two things. We want to assess risk, and we want to assess need. And then we want to make an appropriate match for every one of those. So if the risk level is low, it probably means a lower level of supervision, but it doesn't mean that child doesn't have needs that need to be met. So, but you want to meet those needs and provide services at that lower level of supervision. So I shouldn't be, as a parent, I shouldn't say, in order to get my child substance abuse treatment, I need to put him into residential care. There should be a community-based option for substance abuse treatment rather than have to commit a child into placement to receive that kind of care. So that's the first decision point there is, am I assessing risk and need, and am I doing a good match for each? Then I look at the outcomes. Am I seeing low reoffense rates? Am I seeing good mental health outcomes, education outcomes, behavioral health outcomes, etc.? If I am, then my system may be operating pretty well. And by when I say this, I'm not talking about looking at five cases. by looking at 100 cases or 200 cases and see, is it generally working well? If it's not working well, I need to look at what's not working well. And so the beauty of the slide is it may be that the very assessment we've been talking about is not being administered well, that the workers who have been trained to do the JCP aren't actually administering it with efficacy. So they're getting skewed results about risk level and about needs, and they're moving the child in a different direction than they need to be moved in. Or they're doing a great job, but your county attorney and your judge are not listening to the outcomes of those assessments and making alternative determinations from the bench or in the prosecutor's office, which they're entitled to do. But that's where we may be going haywire. Or you may be sending them to services that are not effective. So for me, that's the triad. Are you doing strong assessment? Does it lead to a good match? And are you delivering high-quality services? And that was the work we began doing about a year ago, a little bit over a year ago, with Clackamas County in the evidence-based decision-making platform.
Can you give me an evidence or an example when you talk risk assessment? What would be a youngster who would be, say, okay, this youngster's low risk, but this one's high risk? Can you just be a little more specific of what you might, what
you want to jump in?
In Oregon, we have...
Qualify risk to whom?
Yeah, right. So in Oregon, we use a risk assessment tool called the JCP, which stands for Juvenile Crime Prevention Risk Assessment. And it is a score of 0 to 30. And depending, there's demarcation points. If you're below an 8, you're low risk. If you're below a 14, you're middle, 8, you know, 9 to 15, you're a medium risk. If you're above a 15, you're high risk. So that helps kind of us to identify where kids fall in terms of their risk level.
So I'd have to look at the document to get an idea of what those questions are.
Yes.
That's kind of what I'm trying to think in my head. I mean, what...
Right, so the questions are really based on those circles that Shay showed earlier. There are different domains of risk factors, so family, peers, schools, as Shay already identified, the... individual characteristics like antisocial thinking, antisocial beliefs, those types of things. So that is actually a list of 30 different risk factor questions that our staff administer when they do a risk assessment.
Okay, thank you.
So happy to show that to you if you're interested in seeing
it.
So the risk is whether they are a low, moderate, or high risk to reoffend.
Right.
Now, it's not predicting the type of offense. It's not saying they're going to steal a car versus they're going to commit a robbery. But you can look at the prior history of a child and know what kind of behavior they've been involved in to get a sense of what their future behavior might be as well.
Yes, I think there's a differentiation between risk to themselves versus risk to the community.
Exactly.
And I was wondering if that was calculated in.
Yeah. I think there are other assessments, like the CANS assessment and others, that are done that are looking at other well-being type factors. So this becomes critically important, that you're using a tool that can be validated. So this isn't like someone said, these seem like there's 30 good questions. These are tools that are developed and then validated as having predictive reliability. And the JCP has been validated. And in Clackamas County, you're also developing a pre-screen to the JCP that would also be used as a preliminary look at what's going on with the child. The second piece of what Clackamas is doing is to say, how are we going about doing this match? So right now they are in the process, through Christina's leadership, of taking data, historical data, of offense type, risk level, and looking at outcomes based upon the particular types of interventions that are taking place. Now this is a something in process, it's not done yet. But what they'll have then is the historical data to say, for a youth committing a certain type of offense, alleged to, and then presents a certain risk level, that this is the best option we have to maximize recidivism reduction. So we did the same effort in Florida statewide. And what we showed was when you develop the type of tool that I'm talking about, which is what's being developed here in Clackamas, you're able to maximize recidivism reduction. This is what happened in Florida. When they used that sweet spot where the disposition matrix, they called it, led them, recidivism rate was anywhere from 18 to 21%. When they went beyond what was being recommended, so a more punitive disposition, they went up to 35% recidivism. And important, when they went under, when there was too little being done, it went up to 50%. So this notion about how to balance and find is depicted here. And what's the beauty of what you can do here in Oregon and in Clackamas is you can track your data. And over time, you can say, are we actually making decisions as an agency, as a court, even at OIA, that leads to how we get to better outcomes for these young people? Because if you reduce recidivism, it means you are driving the factors that lead to delinquency, family, peer group, school, community. All those domains are being impacted in a positive way. Any questions about the slide? Besides the photograph slide of my family, this is my best slide ever. It captures 15 years of research. Okay, so I want to move the conversation to the multi-systems youth. Those kids are known both to child welfare and criminal justice. We have various definitions of what a crossover youth is. We focus on that middle domain, dually involved youth. Youth who have an open current case in child welfare, who also have an open current case in juvenile justice. A duly adjudicated youth would be a youth who's been adjudicated dependent in child welfare. It means they fully penetrated the system. And then duly adjudicated means they're adjudicated in the delinquency system as well, which means they're not being diverted out of juvenile justice. They're not being put in voluntary services in child welfare. They've gone through both systems, and they're committed on both ends, so to speak. That outer ring of crossover youth more broadly would be any youth who has been abused and neglected, whether we know about it or not, and any youth who's been involved in delinquent behavior, whether we know about it or not. Technically, that is a crossover youth, and that youth is probably going to have more negative life outcomes. We have focused on the dually involved because our work at Georgetown has been on how do you change systems behavior? How do you change system policy and system practice? And you can't change that unless you know about the child and the family. And how do those systems work together? So what are those characteristics about this population? And I focus on this population because in my career as a prosecutor, the policy work I did at DOJ, the U.S. Department of Justice, and at the Child Welfare League told me that if you want to maximize impact, you're going to find these kids and you're going to try to bring them back on a positive youth trajectory, that these kids have the biggest downside in terms of opportunity to go, their lives to go in a negative pathway. So girls are more likely to cross over from dependency to delinquency than boys are. So whereas normally in a community, we might see girls in the juvenile justice system who are not child welfare involved, 25%, 26%. In this particular study that I cite here, 29%. But for crossover cases, girls represented 30 to 50%. So we want to look at why might girls be crossing over from dependence into delinquency at higher rates, and that would be something that we would study and do study in our work. African-American children. So I said earlier that an African-American child is generally overrepresented in child welfare and in juvenile justice. So let me give you random percentages. Assume that the African-American population in the community is 5%. Assume that the child welfare African-American population is 8%. Assume that the juvenile justice African-American population is 12%. The crossover African-American population will look more like 20%. So even though the underlying populations are both disproportionate, when you put them together, it drives it to even a higher level of disproportionality. So since most kids cross over from child welfare to juvenile justice, there is the opposite. We want to look at what are the factors that might be driving that for an African-American child. And if you're an African-American girl, you're at the very highest risk of crossing over in any community that we've done our work in. This crossover work has been done in over 120 counties in the country through our center in Georgetown. So we have a lot of experience with this factor. We see also a very high proportion of LGBTQ and GNCT youth in this population. 20% crossover youth identify as LGBTQ or gender nonconforming.
GNCT.
Gender nonconforming.
Transgender.
I think that's it.
Yeah. It's part of the alphabet soup.
Yes. But even sometimes we get stuck on it. 13.6% of the crossover males and 39.3% of crossover females identified as LGBTQ. So this is a population. We actually have a whole certificate program at Georgetown on this population and how systems can work differently to keep them from going deeper and deeper into these systems. And then a very high opportunity chance of going into special education. so tend to have learning and behavioral challenges that result in academic and disciplinary struggles at school. So these are some of the characteristics that we begin to see. I'm giving you some studies here, so when Alex and I put together the presentation, we wanted to give you the actual citations, but I have to stress this shows up in almost every county we do this work in. So it's not just there was a random research study in Minnesota. This is beginning to show a real trend nationally. In terms of psychosocial, we see a lot of issues around suicidal ideation and attempted suicide. We also see substance use issues, mental health issues. So we know that for the crossover population, the figures tend to be anywhere from the mid-70s to the mid-80s, that they have a diagnosed mental health, substance use, or co-occurring disorder. In terms of child welfare involvement, it generally doesn't matter whether it's neglect or physical abuse or sexual abuse. They're all pretty equally related to a child crossing over. There's high rates of out-of-home placement, however, and often group placement instead of family-based placement. So this is a big thing we look at. When children are removed from their home, are there adequate placements with families, foster families, kin care, so relatives will take a child, even fictive kin, you know, family, friends, stuff like that, or whether there is a tendency to move kids into group facilities. That group facility placement is correlated with higher rates of crossing over than a family-based placement for these children. We also look at placement changes. Every time a child changes placement, there's an increased probability that they will cross over into the delinquency system. And we also see, of course, what I've described, they are less likely to form pro-social bonds. So whether it be with peer group or adults, how can you create a connection to that meaningful adult if you're constantly being moved around?
Shifting from one place to another.
Yeah. And then generally, the longer a child stays in child welfare, the more we see that child cross over at higher rates. And the juvenile justice side, we see less than half of them charged with a violent offense. And I have to say that the vast majority of the violent offenses are simple battery and simple assaults. We are not talking about a population, although I could give you a one-off, but we're not talking about a population that's out there robbing banks or committing driveway robberies or home invasions. Most of the incidents, those simple assaults, simple batteries, are occurring in placement, or they're occurring in school. And so we focus a lot on those placements in schools in our work. Yes, sir?
You separate out what I would consider the more typical kind of, you know, junior high school kinds of fights that boys get into in particular.
Yeah. Yeah.
As opposed to a straight-up vicious assault.
Yeah.
Do you lump those together? Because I'm afraid that kids that do what boys do,
yeah,
get in fights,
yeah,
end up getting thrown out of school, et cetera, instead,
yeah,
of handled internally.
Yeah. No, your point is really well taken. And so we can disaggregate the data to look at the seriousness of the offenses. So to see the simple assault, simple battery, the jostling around in the hallway. I think the problem is that if a youth in a school has been, in a sense, targeted by administrators as being a problem youth, and a lot of those we're seeing, I mentioned the case scenario earlier about a kid who's struggling, begins to act out, they're pushing kids out. And our goal and a lot of our other work is to keep kids in. It's not we don't want them held accountable. It's not that there should be some punishment for behavior. But we have data that's clear that when you push a kid out on the street, that you are basically pushing them into more negative outcomes generally. It's a general expression, but that's what we see happening. So, yes, I can disaggregate how many of these are really vicious, a knife fight, invasion, use of a gun. The vast majority are not that type of behavior for this crossover population. Yet, when they are pushed out of school, arrested from school, when they are arrested at the group home site, they are detained at higher rates, even though the offenses are more minor than what you would normally see detained in your detention center. So one of the first counties we worked on with this population was in Multnomah. And Multnomah had this reputation of really doing detention reform and not keeping kids in detention. We went up there and they said, well, we have 34 kids in detention, so we don't have this problem. And my question was, well, I want to look at the 34 kids. Because you could have 14 of them could be this population that shouldn't be in there either. It could be you should have 20 in there right now for public safety reasons. And sure enough, there were a lot of these crossover kids who simply were being ejected from placement, suspended or expelled from school. No one wanted them back, so they were being detained waiting for suitable placement. And that happens in most places we do this work. They're more likely to receive out-of-home placement, and they're typically younger at the age of their first offense if there's been child welfare involvement, as opposed to no child welfare involvement. Higher rates of recidivism, higher access to services from counties or cities in terms of accessing them. So we're seeing a lot of historical involvement with child welfare increases the likelihood of recidivism. It also, as the next slide will show, increases the likelihood that they're going to be referred for services. So the reason we created this slide was to make the point that referring for services isn't good enough. With the complexity of these kids' lives, there not only needs to be a referral, there needs to be assurance that there'll be access. So we're giving you three different data points here. And this all came from a study from Dennis Culhane in 2011 in Los Angeles, but there's similar data, I think on the next slide, from New York. 74% referral for therapy, only 55% actually accessed the service they were referred to. 43% referred to academic, 17% access. 33% for medication, 15% access.
Is that because they didn't show up, or because there wasn't sufficient
usually,
service?
It's usually a combination of reasons. So usually the service exists that they're being referred to, but it could be that they're not getting transportation to go. So Jim, I know you were, if I have my memory correct, mayor of Milwaukee at one time. Mm-hmm. So we did work in Milwaukee, and we looked at the referral and access rates. And the referral rate was high, the access rate was low. And so we started to unpack, like you're suggesting, the data. Why were these kids not actually accessing? And we found is the most common reason was the location they were told to go for services was about 25 miles from where they lived. And in Milwaukee, if you're in the urban area and you're told to go out somewhere, you might need to figure out two or three connections to get someplace.
I bet you're thinking of another Milwaukee. Are you thinking of a different...
Oh, I'm thinking Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
No, Milwaukee, Oregon. In Clackamas County.
In Clackamas County, okay. My bad. I saw Milwaukee and I figured you made your way west.
Restriction now.
Thanks,
though. Someday, maybe, right?
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, this access issue is something we have to pay attention to at disposition. So in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, they actually revisited their assessment tool because kids that they assess as low to moderate risk were showing up as high risk. It was because they weren't actually getting to any of the services they were being referred to, and they were reoffending at higher rates. So this access point is an important one. And the study that was done, follow-up study by CIDI in New York City, which is their research institute, amplifies the same point. And of course, crossover youth cost you more. We did this work in a small county in Colorado, Morgan County, and some of you may know it. And I talked to the presiding judge, and I said, Judge, you maybe have 12 of these kids. Are you sure you want to develop a whole practice model around crossover youth? And he said, these kids are my high flyers. We calculate from the point they first become involved in our system to when they graduate often into the adult system, they cost me about $1 million in treatment services the court pays for. So, yeah, I want to get involved because this is one data point figure for crossover youth that came out of a Culhane study, but the point is magnified over the lifespan of a child. Okay, so that's the research and the data behind the crossover youth practice model. Now I'll try to move quickly so we can open it up for any additional questions you have. So we developed a practice model. Based upon that research and data, we said how would systems need to change their behavior in order to get to better outcomes? What would it look like that would be different? One, there'd be more information sharing, where systems tend not to want to share information, being concerned about confidentiality, which we are too, but erring on the side of caution, often don't share information they're actually entitled to share with the appropriate agreements. Integrating data systems, so you can do the tracking I mentioned that Christina wants to do, looking at historical data. We have to integrate data systems to be able to track that kind of information over time. And then, can we even identify a young person as being known to multiple systems? Will the child welfare system data system talk to the juvenile justice data system? And I think those are the things we've seen as challenges. So the phase one of our practice model is identify the child, set up a system to identify the youth as being involved at the same time in both child welfare and juvenile justice. Screen them for detention, looking if they're not a public safety risk for an appropriate place for them as soon as possible. And then if the offense is a low-level offense, create a diversion opportunity for that child rather than reject them from the diversion because of the perception that they're high risk because of their needs, not their actual risk level of the community. So that's our first phase of what we do in working with the community, is how do we do those things in an effective way. Oftentimes we find these systems aren't talking to each other at all. Their child could be navigating their way through the juvenile justice system, and it's not even known to them that the child welfare case exists. Phase two is how, when we determine the involvement in both, do we do an aligned or joint assessment from the two systems? So child welfare is actually sitting down with juvenile justice court officers and making an assessment together about what is the best course of action for this child. If I had a parent next to me of a crossover youth, what they would tell you is that my experience has been I go into a child welfare courtroom and I'm told what I need to do to get my child back or to avoid losing my child. 2 weeks later, I go into a delinquency courtroom and I'm told what my child has to do in order to comply with probation. They're not talking to each other, realizing that I've been sent into treatment by the child welfare system. At the same time, my child's sent into treatment. Part of it is a family component that I'm being told to do in both worlds. I have three kids. Anyone who has three kids will struggle. And they're telling me to do all of this and still keep my job. So what we're trying to do is to say, by doing joint assessment planning, you can coordinate what you're asking a child and family to do to be compliant and to be effective. And that's what we hear from families, young people, and by the way, professionals, when they do this work in a different way. Then the last piece is, once that determination is made, make sure there's coordinated case management going on. That just doesn't stop at the courthouse door or, you know, front door. It is going on an ongoing basis. The child welfare worker is talking to the juvenile court officer or probation officer. How's the child doing? How's the family doing? What do we need to do to elevate some support system for that child? And then all the way on into case closure to think about strong supports for that young person and family. What we provide and what we're providing in Clackamas right now is site-based training and technical assistance to implement the model. So what are the policies and practices that have been shown to be effective, and how do those work in Clackamas County? We are not sitting here with a cookie-cutter approach. If Clackamas County does something differently and what we've seen done in 20 other communities is impossible here, then we're going to work to do it the way Clackamas County can do it best. What kind of training are you going to do for your workers across systems to know exactly what's expected of them in doing the work in a different way? What performance measures and quality assurance system will be set up to make sure it isn't just a nice, shiny object of the day, and then it fades 2 years later when another project comes up? But how do we actually maintain some integrity behind the work over time to get to effectiveness? There's a peer-to-peer learning opportunity. We've done this in other counties, both in Oregon and around the country, so you can compare notes about how they did it. There's a web-based platform to provide support for you all, as well as our research and data team. And Alex is part of that. So what we're doing is saying, it's not just you're going to implement something, you're going to measure it over time, and you'll be able to show two things. Did the system change? Did practices change? And two, did you get more effective outcomes for these young people and families?
I'm assuming you have a baseline to compare to 2 years from now?
So what we do is we start out with some baseline data as a preset. And right now, I think we just finished that benchmarking.
In other words, yes, then we have a baseline.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we go and do pre-seq for crossover and post. So it's three data sets. And then these are some of the outcomes that we've seen around the country. Now, reductions in recidivism in juvenile justice, reductions in new sustained petitions, use of pre-adjudication detentions being reduced safely, and then APLA, for those of you who are familiar with child welfare, is a permanency goal, which is an alternative planned permanent living arrangement, APLA, which means basically this child's not going to be adopted, not be reunified, not put in a guardianship. This child will age out of the system. And we saw a propensity for crossover kids to be put in that category at a higher rate than other kids. So our goal was to reduce the use of it, and we've seen that as well. Increases, educational outcomes, pro-social activities, improved behavioral health, increased use of diversion, dismissal, more reunification, more home placement, and greater levels of social supports for these kids. So these are the outcomes that we've seen. These are the jurisdictions. You'll have this as a thing to look at in case you want to see the other places we've done the work. And then these are the studies that I referenced showing those outcomes. So I'm not going to go into more detail about them. One of the more exciting things that we've seen is that in California, a small state a little bit south of you, Their Child Welfare Clearinghouse, their Evans-Based Clearinghouse, just designated the CYPM, the Cross Review Practice Model, as a promising research evidence in the child welfare domain. So this will mean that we've got the rigorous research to show its effectiveness as well. And that's some background information. So it's a lot of information. That's normally about a half a day's worth of material consolidated. Mm-hmm. I'd love to open it up for any questions you might have, because what I'm seeing in terms of your goals around safe, secure, and healthy communities is this falls right on all fours with what we're trying to do with this.
Yeah, I really like the science and the research behind this, and it's so interesting that you just take a concept that is pure common sense, that you have systems talk to each other and you're going to create better outcomes for the kids.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you really quantify it. I'm just curious. I found myself sort of cringing when I kept hearing the word crossover.
Yeah.
I'm curious how kids think of themselves, because like you, there are some kids you call, well, he's learning disabled, or he's dyslexic, or he's this or that, or if you were labeled a crossover youth, it seems like that would be a tremendous struggle to think, wow, I'm a crossover youth.
Yeah. It's not the first time I've heard it, Sonia. We do a lot of youth groups, panels of youth talking about it. And I, for some youth, it has been like, I don't like any label. I don't like being dropped off in the foster care van in the morning to school. That in and of itself is a label of who I am. I'm a foster kid. And some kids have said, I don't like being called a crossover youth. I mean, this is my life story we're talking about here. Other youth have said, actually, I like it. But someone's finally named it. But this is what's happening to me. And no one has named it before. That I'm in these systems and I'm crossing over between them and no one's paying attention to it. So I've heard in a lot of different ways. Other people call it dually involved youth. That may be a better term. You know, we sometimes use that as a reference. But I find the kids want to be treated as an individual. And even though we have a bucket we call crossover youth, our entire system is about identifying and treating this youth in a youth-centered, family-centered, strength-based way that they really appreciate. So I'm hoping the label doesn't scare anybody away.
Right, and I also think your point is excellent, Commissioner Fisher, because we don't want to label kids, and as we're developing how we're going to manifest this in Clackamas County, we can decide how we, the language we use, how we express ourselves. So, you know, instead of, oh, this is the crossover team that's working to help you, we can decide to make it, hey, you know, we're introducing ourselves as people who are invested in helping you. We don't necessarily have to label, use that vernacular with kids and families. So that's something we can talk and think about.
Do this in Omaha, they called it Youth Impact. You're in our Youth Impact Project, youth having an impact.
Which obviously doesn't have that same kind of stigma to it. So, yeah. So, but that's something to be sensitive
to. No, I didn't know if it did have a stigma. I just was wondering.
Yeah.
No.
I'm just very sensitive.
Yeah.
I always think that, you know, being a businessman, when you tell me it's $1 million once a kid gets in this system to get them out, maybe, you know, a lifetime, that's huge. I mean, when we look at adults in the system, or mental health, you know, because they can't get access to medication, all those things, it adds up.
Yeah.
And we can be a lot more efficient. I used to really be involved in justice at AOC, Association of Oregon Counties. I chaired the committee for many years and worked with various DAs about juvenile justice and what they thought was the best practice. And I always heard that term, best practices. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be that, and Ken worked in the juvenile justice system, the scare tactics, or take the kid to the jail.
Scared straight.
Yeah. Or
work for me.
Yeah. Well, when I was a kid and got into trouble, my dad was the mayor, so they'd just say, "What would your dad say?" And that was enough to scare me. You know, it's a lot. I don't know. You can tell me that how a child may be going one direction, go the other.
And like Sonia said, that she should have maybe been in the system, but something, some person, something changed her direction. I know that happened to me. It probably happened to you, all of us. But some of it's attitude, you know. I think that generally I have an attitude, a very positive attitude. But where that came from, I can't really say, you know, but which parent that came from, which brother, which sister, which teacher. But a lot of it's about attitude and changing the kid's attitude that there's hope. Hope's another great thing. That it's not all forever going to be the way it is, that you have to hope for the future. I think that's really one of the key tools that gets us beyond where we may have gone.
I mean, in some ways, systems, if they do their job well, first of all, they shouldn't be raising kids, but they should be connecting kids to those meaningful adults that give them hope.
Very much done.
I mean, you hit on those themes. If the system is doing its job well, it is figuring out how to navigate with that family a path forward that creates those opportunities for them. When my wife and I mentioned she's a psychologist, psychotherapist, and when we talk about her work, we say our work is really the same. It's about love, opportunity, and hope. That these systems need to figure out how to reconnect kids to those essential elements in their life in a way that we can back off and those elements take hold long term.
So yes. Another question. So I was involved years ago. I was a case manager for children with developmental disabilities. I'm also a parent of a child with a developmental disability. And for a while, we had a dual system between it was then SCF, Services for Children, Families, and Developmental Disabilities, where the policy was to coordinate between both systems when you had a family that was challenged with a child with a developmental disability. And it was an absolute complete disaster because the agencies fought and there was all this turf and there were families caught in the middle and it was just a terrible policy where there's a lot of shrapnel that happened for these families. And so then eventually the system evolved and developmental disabilities then does the foster care and does those services, and it's one system. So I'm just wondering, with these two systems between child welfare and juvenile, what would, if there was to be an integration where there was one system, what would be the better system in order to address all the needs of the family? And I'm just guessing it would probably be the more child-centered system, looking at what is the needs of the child and supporting the family. I mean, I just get concerned about the turf, where bureaucracies...
Right, so that's what I think is so powerful. This is not a policy model. There's policy involved, but it's a practice model. So the fact that we've got Kevin Long sitting here, the child welfare manager for our county, who is working with his teams and his folks to say, we are a group of organizations that are child-centered, so we want to make sure that we commit to not having those turf wars and working through how are we going to work together with keeping what is best for that child and that family front and center. Because in our current structure, as you've identified, Commissioner, you know, Kevin's with a state agency. Juvenile is with a county agency. The world in Oregon isn't set up in a way currently where it could be all under one organization because we're just not designed that way. It used to be many years ago when OYA, before OYA was created, they were part of the SCF and then became their own separate agency. So our hope and our reason for investing in this and committing so much time and resource and leadership energy to it is because we want to accomplish exactly what you just said. That's our goal.
And if I could just add to that, I think the key for us is, I've seen all sorts of structures. I've seen Vermont actually has a blended agency that they're all together. But most of them are in a disparate structure of some kind. Even the ones that are umbrella under human services, child welfare, juvenile justice, behavioral health, they're still these fiefdoms. And so our goal is to leave a jurisdiction with a clear set of protocols that the agencies have signed off on, exactly how they will work these cases together. So that's written. It took us 6-8 months in Marion County
for them to solidify that protocol and whatever process they go through to make it their regulatory set of rules. And then we had to train. The workers had to be told, this is how the policy and practice will unfold. Now you're being trained, and this is how you will be measured in your performance, whether you actually do this in a different way. For me, that's the only way long-term you change the behavior of a system, which in essence, is changing the worker's behavior. But your point's right on the money. But the answer I've come to in 41 years of doing this is you go straight to what we all agree to do. We sign it, and we codify it. And whichever way we codify our work. That's what I'm hoping we can do here in Clackamas.
So, Martha and Ken, we need to finish up, so go ahead.
Has there been any research done on what you might call, and we're talking about systems, bureaucracies, agencies, trained individuals, psychology, law, the whole nine yards. Has there been any research on what you might deem an informal system? Maybe going back to the resiliency piece again, where a youngster is able to find a there that isn't largely system-based, but it provides the same level of stability. I'm just thinking of one of our sons who was never in the system,
right. But
he's our boy, and he just showed up one day and didn't leave, and that was that. Yeah. Has there been any research on, I mean, we're talking about, like, again, these bureaucracies, these systems, and yet sometimes there's an organic
natural supports
we're about to test that notion in a new project that we started, but there may be research on it already. But our project is going to be, if you have children acting out in ways that might move them to the front door of the juvenile justice system, what could you do in an informal system instead? So a community-based, family-based, faith-based system that would wrap themselves around that child and that behavior, what could you do in that way? So it's called transforming juvenile probation into a non-formal approach.
Yeah, because
we're going to test that in 7 communities starting this November.
I'd be really interested, if you wouldn't mind, in just kind of keeping up with that piece of it, because that's kind of been my experience. And I'll never forget the night he kind of got into trouble, and a young guy, no big deal. I don't know if they were messing with mailboxes or something, but it was interesting to me because his parents were still involved, but the community saw us as the parenting unit, in a sense. So they just kind of hauled them up to, you know, our house, and that was just the way it was, and it worked out very well, actually, for everybody in the end. So I'm kind of curious. Yeah, I know, but I'm wondering that, again, how did that happen with that notion of resiliency? How did he seem to make a choice that there was a safe space? Mm-hmm. And he was lucky enough to be on a 60-acre farm where he had a lot of room to mess around, so he was out of trouble.
Well, but I'll report back to you how our...
Pardon me?
I'll report back to you how our research goes.
I'd really be very seriously interested.
Yeah,
in,
I will.
Yeah. And I did take some classes with Yuri Bronfenbrenner at Cornell.
You did?
Yeah, College of Human Ecology.
When I bring up Yuri Bronfenbrenner, I get a lot of people's hands raised that they remember him from their books. He's my favorite.
Well, he was wonderful. He was wonderful. College of Human Ecology at Cornell.
Wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Ken.
So one of the ways of breaking down silos is eliminating architecture. In other words, get the POs out of the PO office and the social worker out of the social worker office and put them in the same office and assign them the same cases and let them start. And maybe you just do that with 3 and 3 to get started, and you have a basis of comparison about how it's working against them being in separate offices with some of our population. But the most effective way I've ever seen of breaking down silos is getting people out of their individual buildings and into the same place, for starters.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if you're considering that. If you are, I would highly recommend it.
So some of our sites that we've worked with historically have done co-location. So they've gone to that understanding that we've got workers who are working with the same child, same youth, same family.
Yep.
They should be in the same offices.
And they go to the same training at the same time for the same purpose.
Yeah.
If you keep them in separate architecture, I'll tell you right now, you'll end up with the turf wars and all the rest of it. Once they're in that same office and they have to actually work together on behalf of the same kid with the same case file in front of them, with all the data from the social work side all the way through the law enforcement side, they'll be able to make much better assessments on what is the best outcome for that kid.
We found the same thing to be true for judges. When they're bifurcated dockets, we've tried, if it's possible, to create a blended docket where if a child who's in the child welfare system gets arrested, they're going to be heard by that judge who has the child welfare case. Some places that's doable, some places that's not doable.
Even you're really dealing with different disciplines that tend to function this way,
yeah,
but are actually, especially in dealing with kids, should be functioning this way.
Okay. So. We could just send them to Planet B. Well, there's a sign behind you. Planet B.
Anyway, my thoughts.
Thank you.
Thank you. For the appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thanks. Well, Gary, what's up?